Welcome to episode 10, the inaugural first episode under our new name, the Generative AI Podcast. Originally, I had intended to cover AI broadly, but with all that's happening with generative AI, including the launch of GPT-4, I decided to narrow the focus. In this episode, I speak with scientist entrepreneur Arjit Ray. Arjit is a PhD candidate at Boston University. We have a far-ranging conversation about generative AI, why it's so hard to get DALL-E to create a pizza exactly the way we want, a crucial problem to solve, how one goes from scientist to entrepreneur in a startup, which is training AI to run marketing focus groups. Procter & Gamble, if you're listening, you should be keenly interested. Please enjoy my conversation with Arjit Ray. Welcome to the Super Prompt Podcast. Join me, your host, Tony Wan, as I go under the hood with AI experts, engineers, and entrepreneurs to explore burning questions, pitfalls, and best practices. Whether you're inside the industry or not, I hope to reveal something you haven't yet discovered. We laugh, we cry, we iterate. For early adopters of generative AI. So Arjit Ray, tell me if I pronounced your name correctly.
Yeah, that's perfect.
Okay, great. Arjit Ray, thank you for agreeing to come on this podcast. I'm looking forward to our conversation. Why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself, how you got into technology, education, and how you ended up what you're doing now, which is developing AI software and potentially turning it into a company.
I am a second year PhD student at Boston University. I work with Professor Kate Sanko here. How I got into AI, before my PhD, I happened to work with visual question answering systems during my master's and I really liked it.
Okay, so we need to pause right there.
Okay.
Because you just said visual questioning systems. So
yeah.
I don't know what that means.
Sure. Yeah. So I used to work on AI software that can answer natural language questions about images. So for instance, if you can point your camera to a picture of a pizza and ask, is the pizza vegetarian? Can it look at the image and can it understand the semantics of the image and the semantics of the language, like the question you're asking, and answer yes or no, depending on what the pizza is? I used to work on deep neural nets that have this capability, and I used to work on improving their robustness, improving their explainability, like are they consistent with the different answers? Uh-huh. And I really liked it, and I was at like a research lab. It's called SRI, Stanford Research Institute. I loved the research, and so I wanted to take it forward, and I wanted to be able to lead research, and I thought that PhD is the way to do it, and so here I am.
Interesting, because it's funny you use food as an example, because my inaugural episode for AI Cafe was about an AI that can tell if something's a hot dog. So I was thinking about, what kind of questions would I want to ask about my pizza? You know, is that sausage or pepperoni? What kind of sausage is it? You know?
Yeah, so it was not just food. It was about everything. I just used that as an example.
Okay, right. And you said there was a particular domain you looked at, which was medical images, which might be a little bit more useful than what kind of toppings are on the pizza.
Sure. Yeah. And that was like the hope, like you can ask questions about medical x-ray images and stuff like that. But yeah, that was a very specific application where my research was more like an academic testing for AI models, right? So it was like, if AI can answer questions, natural language questions on any images, it's sort of like a test. It's sort of like a Turing test that AIs understand the semantics of image and language. So it knows what it's doing.
All right.
Yeah. And also for visually impaired assistants.
Oh, interesting. So for the visual impaired, you can kind of see what's going on in the world or what's going on your computer.
Yeah.
Oh, interesting.
Or it just, you can ask questions like, hey, is it safe to cross the road? Or is this a can of beans or whatever? So if you're not 100% like that, we were pitching that as an application actually. So if you're visually impaired, what kind of questions can you ask? And you can point your camera, wear some sort of headset and the camera looks at things and you can ask questions about what's in front of you.
Wow, you're going to put seeing eye dogs out of business if this is successful. You threw out a term you probably should explain, because I want to make sure this podcast reaches a little bit wider audience. So Turing test, how would you use the word Turing test in this particular case? Like, what is a Turing test and why is this a Turing test?
Turing tests are a concept in computer science where you can, say, ask questions or converse with a computer. So if the person cannot tell a difference whether they are talking to a human or a computer, then a computer is said to pass the Turing test. So it's basically saying that the computer has the sort of intelligence or it understands the semantics of language in a way it's indistinguishable from a human.
Yeah.
Why is it a Turing test? Because natural language is a very intuitive and a natural way of interfacing. So for instance, people talk to other people using natural language. And so if you can ask questions to a computer and the computer responds in a way where you cannot distinguish between whether it's a human responding back to you or a computer responding back to you,
yeah,
that's basically a Turing test. So that's why question answering capabilities are basically used in Turing tests mostly.
So basically your goal is, if we go back to the pizza example, mm-hmm, whether you're asking the AI questions about this pizza or you're asking me questions about this pizza, mm-hmm, if it's indistinguishable between these answers of me describing to you what this pizza is and what the AI is describing, then it passes the Turing test.
Yeah.
And basically, I lose my job as a pizza describer.
Exactly. That is correct.
And you know, for your PhD, did you continue this line of research or did you pivot into some other topic?
So these days, the community has slowly pivoted. So we don't care about specific capabilities like question answering anymore. Instead, we care about foundational models, which can do everything. So it's not just question answering, but it can do image captioning, it can do object recognition, localization, etc. So these days, I mostly focus on these like large foundational models that have generalized capability that can do everything. And I focus on improving their robustness, improving their explainability or their how, if they can think in real compositional terms. So for instance, if you have long chain reasoning, can it actually accurately do that, etc.?
But is it focused around images still or more broadly?
Yes, the focus is still around images and text and also like going into videos and audio these days. But yeah, the primary focus is still image and text.
Okay. And you just used another term that I think it'd be good to explain, because I think I know what you mean, but I've never mm-hmm heard it described that way, which is long chain reasoning. Mm-hmm. You know, describe what that is, because I think that means like if you have a long conversation with AI, mm-hmm, that it sounds like you're talking to a human who remembers the context and what you talked about before. Mm-hmm. That's how I interpret it, but why don't you provide a more accurate definition?
Sure, yeah. You're correct, actually. It is sort of like that. If you think about dialogue, then yes, it is about remembering a long history of conversation. What I also deal with is like, say if you have an AI system that understands images, and say if you say, can you find me the image which has a red cube beside a purple cube on top of a large metal sphere or something like that? So can it understand these different logical hops of reasoning? So you have to know that there is a large sphere and then there is a red cube beside that and whatever, right? And so if you have multiple attributes and multiple objects, so for instance, can you say, can you remember where I put my square white plate with a purple border? So can it understand all of these attributes that it has to be on the plate? And can it find images with that? So this is the sort of like applications that I'm focusing on right now. Yeah.
Yeah. It's funny because this applies to me trying to make DALL-E draw a specific thing. Mm-hmm. And I'm realizing a lot of times it doesn't get what I'm trying to describe. Although you would understand what I'm trying to describe.
Yep.
But I'm like, how do I manipulate this thing to get the bunny rabbit on top of the box next to the beaver on top of a tree? Is the bunny rabbit on the top of the tree or is the beaver? Like, it's very, DALL-E gets confused about stuff like that. So I'm imagining that as you get further down your research, something like DALL-E a year from now is going to be able to understand me more for those sorts of situations.
Exactly. Yeah, that is basically what I also focus on. So making these generative models or detection models more compositional. And compositional means what you are saying. So if you have multiple attributes and multiple objects, making sure like they bind to the right attribute, binds to the right object in a way human would understand. So aligning it to the human ways of perceiving language.
Is the challenge just one of training? Or is it some like more algorithmic challenge? Because just assume like if AI listens to enough people talking about rabbits and beavers and trees and things like that, it's going to know what goes where. Or is there something else at play here? Because you're spending research on it, so I'm assuming it's more than just training.
Yeah.
Tell me what the challenges are in a way I might be able to understand.
That's a great question, actually. And it is an open question in research. we actually still really don't know. We have seen compositionality emerge, like this sort of binding attributes to the right objects emerge better and better with bigger models and bigger data sets. Yeah. Scale definitely plays an aspect. But the returns that we are getting from increasing scale beyond a certain billion scale data sets, the returns are diminishing. So it's plateauing of sorts. So there is definitely something more that is required. Recently, from one of my research, we saw that the architecture definitely matters. So for instance, in these models, we use a layer in the neural network where the image regions attend to like text regions. So for instance, what it means is it like it pays attention to certain image regions, the text input, and the image regions also pay attention to certain text words you're saying. And so having this sort of joint attention helped a lot, for instance.
Okay, that's very abstract for me. You said there's text regions and image regions.
Yeah.
Let's go back to the pizza example. Like use the pizza example to help me understand what you mean by that.
Okay, so for instance, if you say, find an image of a pizza with pepperoni and pineapple, and you have like multiple attributes that have to be on the pizza, right? So if you have, say, a lot of images, and if you have a layer where the word pepperoni has the flexibility to decide which image region to look at. So it will basically scan the image and see, okay, this is where I see a pepperoni. And then the word sausage has the flexibility to independently also look at the image regions and decide where to look at. So if you give it this capability where each text word or token, we say in language, and each image region has the flexibility to selectively choose where to look at in both the image space and the text space. So this image region, for instance, says, okay, which is the most relevant text word for my image region? And it says, oh, it's like a combination of sausage and pepperoni. Okay, fine. So that means this image region has that semantic meaning there. And if you build this into a neural network, if you have these layers where things self-attend and attend to each other, it improves their reasoning capability. So from the data, it learns, oh, if I have to bind sausage, pepperoni, and pineapple onto the pizza, I need to learn it in a certain way where all these sort of text words go to the same region, the pizza, and not like sausage on one pizza and pineapple on another pizza.
Okay. It's literally the physical region of, say, a photograph.
Yep.
Because like I can imagine Dolly doing something like, I'm like, I want a sausage on a pizza. And it will get like a full sausage and superimpose it on like a cheese pizza. And I'm like, No, that's not how sausage works, you know?
Yeah.
They're sliced and they're on a pizza, you know?
But that I think is a data problem.
That's a data problem.
Yeah. I would imagine that if you have enough training data of like sausages on pizza and how it looks like, that would learn it. Where these AI models fail right now, but what it's not good with, for instance, is if you have a cluttered scene and if you have, like, for instance, in the pizza example, if you set a pizza with sausage, pineapple, and pepperoni, it would often retrieve examples of a maybe like one pizza has sausage, another pizza has pineapple, and the other pizza has pepperoni, but not together. And it doesn't understand that I want it all together. That's jointly a data problem and an architecture problem. If you train for it, it learns, okay, well, I should put it all on the same region.
Pizza chefs, your jobs are secure for now.
For now.
All right. We got introduced via a mutual friend who gave me a pitch to something you're working on. Can you describe what it is that you're working on now? It has to do with you applying AI to the realm of focus groups. It's a very specific problem. Tell me how you came across that problem, but maybe first explain what focus groups are and why this is an interesting problem to go use AI to solve.
Mm-hmm. So in business and whatever, like people use focus groups to judge their product ideas or their pitches or whatever it is, right? Your advertising posts. And so what we were working on as a part of the MIT Venture pitch was, can you make an AI that simulates social media or simulate focus groups? So if you have an idea, if you have a post, if you have an image or a text that you want to post online or social media post, it could be a video, whatever, can you use an AI to simulate how users might react or how viewers might react and why? So you can see your reaction in a simulation before you put it out there and before, you know, you inadvertently offend someone or whatever.
The reason that caught my eye is because I've run focus groups before in one of my former jobs. My career has been mostly very technical, but there was a stint for a year or two where I was director of consumer marketing at Cisco, and we actually ran focus groups. It was really fun. It was very similar to what they used to do in Mad Men. I don't know if you've ever seen the Mad Men TV series, but it's about the advertising business, and I don't know, maybe 1950s? I may be getting the decade wrong. But they were doing focus groups for different consumer products behind one-way mirrors. And that was like 1950. The work I did for Cisco was, I don't know, like 2012 or something like that. So we're doing it the same way. You know, 60 years later, 70 years later, we're doing it exactly the same way. Mm-hmm. It's a very physical task because we were launching a product in the UK. Mm-hmm. I flew to the UK from San Francisco and went to maybe three focus groups in three different cities with my PhD researcher, who was the director of our consumer research, and crafted the questions. Mm-hmm. And we posed the questions to people, and we just observed behind this one-way mirror eating terrible food for hours. Mm-hmm. It was such an inefficient process, but very valuable, because in the first 5 minutes, our hypothesis fell apart. We spent all this time crafting messaging statements about our product. Like, oh, it's easy to use, to give you an example. Mm-hmm. And you put it in front of a focus group, and the response was, we're not interested. And the facilitator's like, why not? And they would say like, well, if you're telling me it's easy, it's probably hard to use. So why are you telling me it's easy? Mm-hmm. It was very disheartening because I flew across the ocean. I'm tired. And I'm waiting with excitement because I'm like, they're going to love what we did. But instead, it just fell apart. They hated everything we did. They hated everything. We had to like scrap everything and start over. So it was very useful, but quite expensive because mm-hmm. it was my time, the PhD researcher's time. We debated endlessly before we created the messaging statements that we tested. And then we had to throw it all away and start over. So I think it's a great problem to solve. But how did you come across it? Because it's such a weirdly mm-hmm. inside industry thing.
So it came out of, I also work on detecting, say, misinformation and all of that on social media. That's a big topic right now in AI in general. A lot of people are interested in it. The idea that I had came out of that. So we were trying to make a social media simulator of sorts. So if, say, you put something, say a news agency puts a post image and caption out there, can we basically predict how diverse users would react? And using that, can we detect if something would be radicalizing or not? And most of the previous literature in emotion detection and sentiment detection has been just classifying one of an emotions like happy, sad, anger, which doesn't quite capture the nuance, I believe. And so that's why that idea came out. So we were trying to like say, why would someone be happy? Why would someone be sad? And then during the venture creation process, we found that, hey, what great application is focus groups, for instance.
Okay, I understand.
And yeah, yeah.
yeah. Actually, this is bringing back memories because there's terms like sentiment analysis.
Yeah.
Let's say you're going to rebrand your company and you're going to create like a little statement of five words that summarize what your company does.
Yeah.
You want to know how people respond. Did they get like a warm and fuzzy feeling, or maybe they, like what kind of emotions does it create? Mm-hmm. So that's interesting. So it started from social media, but a lot of the research may have been done related to, you know, the stuff companies cared about for the last 60, 70 years, which is around brand positioning and trying to get consumer reactions to that and focus group work. Okay, so now I understand how the pieces are together. But I guess, how does that connect with the specifics of your PhD research? Is this...
Right. So, I mean, it is still, in a broader sense, image and language understanding, right? So if you put out an image on social media and if you put out a language, can you predict how humans would react? So what we are doing is here is just bringing in the human aspect as well. Yeah. So it is a part of image and language understanding, which is my broader goal for PhD research. And this is just one aspect of it. That's how I would pitch it for now.
Okay. All right. You started out as Arjit, the PhD researcher, mm-hmm. fairly academic. And now we just turned this corner of you're pitching a business idea. Was this something you had always envisioned, even as you started to study computer science? Or was that something you found later that, hey, look, I kind of am interested in building a business? Like, help me understand a little bit, like, the trajectory that got you into pitching these things, mm-hmm. which is kind of part of what you're doing now.
Yeah, from a young age, I feel like I wanted to start like something of my own, like a venture, a company or something. Even in middle school, I opened like a research society, and then, you know, we would like make certain small gadgets and whatnot. And I think it was definitely my interest for a long time. And then I feel like recently, I just didn't want to make a company that is just piecing stuff together. You know what I mean? Like there are certain companies where you just make a product out of existing technology. That's
I know exactly what you mean. Like I've had these conversations with colleagues. It's like, do we want to just make a widget company? You know, you can make a lot of money just building some very useful widget.
Exactly.
And almost all of our answers is no, that's not interesting. You know, we want something. Yeah.
That's boring. Yeah. That's why I came into the PhD, because I feel like if I end up doing something that is my thesis, which is unique and no one has done, that is a great foundation to build a business on top of. And that also gives me a competitive edge. So yeah, that's why I think I came into the PhD, and eventually it would be great if I can figure something out in my PhD that is uniquely mine and I build a business on top of that. And so this was one of the attempts at that.
Interesting. And you said this is a concept you developed and you started pitching. Mm-hmm. And the event that I actually didn't know, we have a mutual acquaintance, a friend, Bill, mm-hmm. who attended this. What was the event he actually attended?
Oh, yeah. So it's a great class, actually. It's a venture studio class at MIT. It's called AI for Impact Venture Studios. The class is designed around like venture capitalists or in general mentors giving you feedback on your ideas, helping you formulate the idea better and better. And then at the end, you have a pitch day where everyone, the final ideas that survive the class pitch, 10 to 15 ideas that pitch, and mm-hmm. You get feedback from mentors, VCs, you get some seed money if you have to. And then, yeah, it's a fun brainstorming class.
And the current academic institution you're part of is Boston University.
Right.
But this is done at MIT. Were you taking the course at MIT, or do they open up to the broader, like greater Boston community?
They have like an application procedure, and then you can submit an application. If you get accepted, you can attend the class basically. Formally, I wasn't like, you know, like getting credit for the class at BU, but I was in the class because I think they're open to the broader community. If you get accepted through the application process, they're open to the broader community. Yeah.
You know the Consumer Electronics Show, right, in Las Vegas, CES. Mm-hmm. Let's say we got like 30 seconds or a minute to pitch. Well, like, how would you pitch your concept?
I would pitch it as, imagine what if you could simulate social media reactions to everything you post and anything you put out there. So for instance, if you're an influencer and you want to test, okay, what would this image and caption that I'm pitching, what reactions would it elicit? If I'm a brand manager, if I am making a statement, like for instance, Adidas made a statement which was derided on social media. So if you could simulate the reactions on the simulator before you put it out to social media, that could save you so much money in like not having to hire focus groups, not having to cause PR issues later on. When Adidas never wanted to offend anyone, what if you can prevent that by having a simulator?
Yeah. Well, since you brought it up, what specifically did do that they later regretted they did?
I think it was a comment that they made like, congrats, you survived the Boston Marathon or something like that.
Oh, that's terrible.
Yeah, but they never meant it to be that way. And it was the focus groups probably didn't just catch it and they apologized and whatever.
So interesting. So they must have, I mean, knowing how big companies work,
yeah,
they must have tested it, or somehow that testing process didn't.
Oh, yeah, I'm sure they did. Yeah, it's just like somehow they didn't catch it because
it fell through.
Yeah, because it was probably in a different country or different, people who weren't connected to the Boston Marathon events.
Yeah, yeah. You know, if you test that like in Louisiana or maybe in Florida, people aren't going to remember
exactly
what happened in Boston.
Whereas an AI, which is trained with many reactions, it has the access to all the news events that have happened.
Yeah.
It is easier for the AI to catch on that error. So, yeah.
Well, you see, the successful pitch, because you got me to start asking questions, you know, and that's what you want. It's like, because if I'm a CMO, I'm thinking about, ooh, I don't want to put my foot in my mouth. I would have wanted to find out more, at least get your business card and have one of my people call you. So,
yeah.
All right. Good job. Good pitch.
Thank you.
If I'm a company, my products could run the gamut. I could be making shampoo or a toaster or a mobile phone. In each of those cases, I'd be recruiting a very specific kind of user mm-hmm. or a kind of prospective customer to test my product. And so do you have to contemplate the actual product? Or are you creating this general capability?
For now, we were focusing on a general capability, like mostly like news images, news captions, because this came out of like a misinformation detection research. So we were focusing on news. But yes, you are right. If it's a very specific industry, like, I don't know, shampoo or something, we might need training data, which is specific to that, like sort of user base and whatnot. But this is something we see in language, vision and language research. You first want to focus on making AI systems that are very generic and they work on generic data. And once you have that sort of large language models that are trained on generic data, they are very easily adaptable to small domains. So if you start from a small domain, it's much harder to actually make it work for the domain because the AI doesn't have enough view of the world, so as to speak, in order to have the intelligence to like understand the semantics and nuances of language. And so if you want to train it on like large scale generic data, just conversations online and whatnot, and then it understands, it gets the intelligence to understand nuance of language. And then if you want, you can easily adapt it for specific industries with much smaller data. Yeah.
Got it. Yeah. It should be very little incremental development there, but not much.
Yeah.
So the training data, is that public domain? You can just suck in all that information and train your model? Or do you have to have special agreements?
We train mostly on public news images and news captions. So we take, like, for instance, BBC news articles, not any of these news channels, and we take their public posts that are on the webpage anyway, and we just like use those.
To use your example of like, let's say it's a BBC news release.
Yeah.
Like, but to gauge people's reaction to it, you need to look at, are you looking at the comment section? And
oh, okay. Yeah. So we collect data for that. So we have workers we hire online. There are these platforms, for instance, called Amazon Mechanical Turk, where you can pay online workers and you can pay like a large range of online workers in many countries, whatnot. And then you can collect the data for that.
Okay, but help me understand, like, basically, are you hiring people that respond to these news articles? Or are they kind of screen scraping existing responses?
No, they're typing out responses.
Okay.
Yeah. So you show them an image and a caption and you say, how do you think people might react or something like that? And they will provide you some examples of what they think people might react. And you can collect this from diverse amounts of people and that gives you a good view of, okay, what are the various ways people can react, for instance?
And typically, these are like publicly released news articles. Is that?
Yes, exactly. Yep.
Interesting. That doesn't seem like it would give you enough. I mean, shampoo, TVs, that reaction doesn't seem specific enough to be usable.
Right. What we are focusing on is mostly releasing a generic model, and then companies can easily adapt it if it's trained on a large amount of like public news. So now the AI model has a generic large scale worldview of how people react to certain image entities and language entities. And if you want to focus it to a very specific industry like shampoos, you can incrementally adapt that using some custom data that you might have. Yeah.
Okay. I understand. Your goal is to build this generic model.
Yeah.
And for that, there's data readily. Well, you can create data for that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then you kind of tweak it based on if you get a particular customer willing to pay
yeah.
and is interested, you can kind of tweak it for the particular market they're in and the particular product that they're interested in testing. Okay, that makes sense. I understand that now.
Mm-hmm.
When it comes to the money you need to get the business going, you're asking for a chunk of seed money. I'm assuming there's a significant portion that gets devoted to creating the data set or acquiring the data set. Can you give mm-hmm. me just rough percentage? Are you spending mm-hmm. half your R&D budget on data acquisition?
I don't know the exact like percentage numbers, but yes, a good amount of money does get spent on creating really good data sets. There are enough publicly available big data sets on images and languages. And I think that's why a lot of people are also working on these domains. So you don't have to spend a lot of money on collecting data unless you're doing something very specific. So that's why we focus on mostly training these generic models where you can use like data sets that these large companies have collected, spending a lot of money already, and use that to like most degree and then get a really good model. If you want to create something very specific, like for instance, we were getting reactions of people or something, you can cheaply adapt it by collecting even small data sets. So yeah, I don't know about exact numbers, but I wouldn't say it's super expensive, but it is a major expense of the company. I would say more than half the expense of R&D does go into data set collection. because after all, data set is the key.
Yeah. So that's interesting. That makes it very different than kind of a traditional software company. If you're spending a third or half of your R&D budget on acquiring the data set or creating the data set, that's a big, big change.
Yeah.
But it's not a staffing issue, right? Because you're employing the services of another entity. It's not like half your engineers are working on the data set collection. It's more like an R&D expense.
Right. Yeah.
Have you done any sort of trials?
Right. So we are doing some like online human studies on that, but mostly from a research perspective, so not from a product perspective. If it does show promise, we can look at some specific products.
I understand. So where you are is just validating that this generic model can work. And is it going back to this Turing test concept? You present this statement, and if the AI is responding as a human would, and you're kind of getting human responses, and when the two become indistinguishable, that's kind of when you feel like, okay, I've got the right generic model.
That is exactly correct. So we put out an AI-generated prediction and a human prediction, and we don't tell which one is which. And then we ask users to pick which one they think is human and which one they think is AI. And if the accuracy is just 50%, it's just random chance or close to random chance, then we can say that, yes, the AI was just as good as a human because a human couldn't tell them apart. It was just random chance.
Wonderful. All right. Okay, so now I'm going to ask you this question as an entrepreneur. How do you know this is something you're going to go forward with? You said you're in the second year PhD, right? Mm-hmm. It might have some impact on how long it takes you or to get your PhD if you devote significant time to this. Like, of course, you have to raise money, you have to hire people. Like, what are the critical things you're looking at, say, over the next year? What are you going to look at to decide if this is something you're going to go forward with?
Right. That is a tricky question. Like you said, I'm in my second year of my PhD, so I have the privilege of having a sort of like safety net. That's a great thing about a PhD. For me, it's like a mental backpacking journey, right? So I'm going to try out a bunch of these ideas. So this is one such idea. I'm trying out other ideas as well. And so depending on what seems promising, I don't necessarily have to decide in 2023 in this year. There are three more years to my PhD. So depending on what seems promising at the end of like, say, another year or two, maybe, something really excites me, something I feel like, oh, these results are insane. They're like unbelievably good or something. And I really feel like I want to put it all in and I want to put all my energy in it. I will go for it. And I think it's just a gut feeling, honestly. Like if I'm not very excited about the problem, like maybe the results are good, but I'm not excited about it because I think it's okay. Like for instance, this thing can easily be solved by ChatGPT or something like that. Then I may not go forward with it, even if the results are okay. But if I see, oh, there is some unique angle to this that someone else cannot just attack, or there's some unique research novelty to this, that's usually my criteria. Like it has to be something cool. It has to be something that other people just can't, you know, solve in whatever. Yeah.
So when you say results are good, I don't even know what that means. Can you help me understand for you what might be good results?
Sure.
Like, and other than accuracy, but I mean, that's very abstract to me. Like what, help me under, just paint out a little bit more what good results means to you.
Yeah, I think for this specific sort of venture idea, the reaction prediction thing, it would be, I would imagine, I don't know exactly how what accuracy would look like even in this situation because you can't quite do it. So you have to hire subcultures of groups. So for instance, people, like there are certain images that, say for instance, people care about climate change and there are images about climate change and there are captions about climate change and we want to predict how people might react to these things. So you basically hire subcultures of groups that care a lot about this issue and you ask them, do you think this is reasonable or not? Because there's this thing in tech sometimes what people do is like you just, you know, generically judge if something is good. And I think that's not good because you want to sort of engage with the community that really cares about something. So for instance, if you are putting things about climate change, you don't want to ask any random person what they think about this news and caption. You want to ask people who care about climate change, for instance, or whatever, if it's like seafood or whatever. And so I would imagine like a good result means the community that really thinks a lot about these issues agree with what the AI predicts and is in synergy with them. And it's a very soft science, which is hard, honestly, because you can't just say, oh, my model is 90% accurate. It doesn't quite mean much. You would want to go to these communities and see if it, like, if most of these communities agree with what the AI is doing and they say, oh, there is really some value in here that normal humans cannot just give you, then I think it's a good signal to go forward with. It's a very holistic sort of evaluation. Yeah.
Yes. But I think to get to that point, you would it would be in partnership with some sort of lead customer because it's you're talking about this kind of this, I guess, product market fit, you know, like this really strong sense of, oh my God, this thing is going to make a huge impact in this particular domain. And well, good luck, because I feel like this could be applied to many different areas. Like it's a matter of finding that right lead customer that wants to do something with it and believes it has like exceptional value. So actually I have another follow-up to the way this technology could be used. Mm-hmm. Like we talked a lot about testing statements. How about generating statements? Is that a completely different problem? Or what you're building actually, if I'm a marketeer and I'm like, hey, look, I'm launching a new shampoo in the US market, targeted at this demographic, like mm-hmm. help me with a messaging statement. Is that something that's directly related to your work, or is it a completely different kind
of thing? No, I'd say it's very related, actually. So for instance, ChatGPT does sort of things like this, right? And so now if you can pair ChatGPT with our sort of network, where if you want to craft the perfect statement to target a demographic or basically, you know, based on societal events or whatnot, you want to craft the perfect statement that gets people on board with a certain societal cause or something, can you do that? And you can use this network to basically guide models like ChatGPT to craft the perfect response.
Yeah. Okay. Interesting. So that's a value prop that you haven't mentioned before, actually. Like there's testing.
Yeah.
That's one aspect. But how about actually helping you generate? Because there's expenses on both sides. Like there's like the running the focus groups. But
yeah.
You know how we got these messaging statements? We hired a super expensive, high-powered ad agency to help us create these statements.
Yeah.
And that was a much bigger spend.
Yeah.
Like hiring that agency was quite expensive. We worked with Ogilvy at the time, which is like the platinum ad agency. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't cheap. You know, that's not part of your pitch now. I mean, is it because it's a harder problem? Is it something you think is a phase two? Like, obviously, you've thought about it. So why isn't that part of your pitch yet?
We actually worked on this before. When I was at SRI, we actually have a patent on this. We explored models on generating personalized images and captions that persuade a specific person or a target demographic to get on board with social causes. We actually had this as a pitch and we won some seed money, actually. It was an internal Shark Tank grant that we won on based on this. And we worked on this, and I think it is a bit of a harder problem. We had some good results, but it wasn't good enough to be marketable. So I feel like this was phase two for us.
Look, I'm not a VC. Because I worked at a big company, I've had a lot of smaller companies pitch to me. What's missing from your deck is a strong roadmap slide.
Yeah.
Where this could go. And this should be a part of the roadmap.
Oh, yeah.
Because I'm telling you, that's a bigger part of the marketing spend than running focus groups.
Yeah, I totally agree. Yeah. I mean, that is eventually where we want to end up. Yeah,
yeah,
for sure.
You mentioned before when I asked you what a successful model looks like. And you said, well, one of the questions is, do I have something really unique here? Or is this something ChatGPT can do? You know, I'm assuming a ChatGPT is the poor man's version of this. Tell me what you're doing might be different than what ChatGPT can do generically, because it's a little bit fuzzy.
Yeah, it is. It's a good point. I think the differences are like ChatGPT wasn't explicitly trained for this. So it is a very specific use application of ChatGPT, I would say. Now, whether larger and larger language models can anyway just do this, they can learn reactions, they can just predict it better than explicitly training to do that, we do not know. So that's why we don't fall in love with the technology. We like that the goal, I think, is what I am really passionate about. Like it's being able to predict. Now, whether it's ChatGPT that does it really well, so which means if ChatGPT can do it really well, it just means you just need bigger and bigger language models that train on more and more data, and you can just anyway do it, and then just specifically tune for certain product market cases, which we would do. Or you have to explicitly train for it. For now, we see that you do sort of need to explicitly train in order to get good reactions. If that changes, that changes. And then we kind of reevaluate how we do our stuff. But I think even then, ChatGPT is just a generic model. We are trying to focus it on a market. So then it's a different sort of use case.
Got it. Well, if you wind the clock forward, let's say 10 years, okay?
Yeah.
Like, can you imagine something like ChatGPT, like if you gave it the right question, it mm-hmm. could kind of give you a very specific result where you're like,
yeah,
I'm launching a shampoo targeted at a demographic of 25 to 45-year-old females in the Boston region. Please provide a brand statement of less than 5 words that make this particular user group feel very happy, you know? Like, basically, it's interesting because the research you're doing now will indeed allow ChatGPT to answer these sorts of questions in the future.
Exactly.
So, like, there's a window of opportunity, certainly. But if you wind the clock far enough, ChatGPT, then it becomes like, are you smart enough to give it the right prompt, you know?
Exactly. And so that is why having the right prompts in these large language models are very crucial. And you don't even have to wind 10 years into the future. I think it's a matter of a few months, honestly. ChatGPT already shows promise in doing these things. And so that's why in my PhD, I work on these foundational large language models rather than specific applications. And so hence we're still debating whether we want to do something very specific, or that's why in the beginning I was telling you we are pivoting to like just foundational image language understanding and making these large models be very good. And then you can have very specific prompts that they do really well on anyway. And you don't have to train on specific data necessarily just because it has seen so much of everything else. It has an idea.
So maybe you should stop your PhD and just focus on like this like narrow average. Because let's say you reach a breakthrough in your PhD research, you will have just eclipsed the opportunity for your company because you've created like a larger, you know, you've kind of wind the clock forward on the general capability.
But that's okay. I mean, if we preclude ourselves, that's perfect. I just don't want someone else precluding ourselves, right?
All right. It's a win either way.
It's right? A win either way, right? Like if I preclude myself, then it becomes an even bigger opportunity with whatever.
But what I enjoy in our conversations is that you really have a true entrepreneur perspective around this stuff, because I don't know how many people I talk to who are very guarded about what they're doing and they're super secretive and asking very general questions. And if you can't answer these in a very direct way, you don't have anything special, you know? Like, I love how you're sharing these things that you're working on without any fear that, oh, someone's going to listen to this podcast and then go and build the thing you're thinking of, because you know this stuff is hard, and you know that as much as you can share, you still have insights that really cannot be conveyed in particular catchphrases or words or in a, you know, hour conversation. You got more juice than that. So you have some deep expertise in this area. So itself is kind of protective. So I appreciate you being very open in what you're doing. And anyone who tries to take this idea and run with it, good luck, because it's hard.
Yeah, I mean, also like whatever I'm saying, like these are well known in NLP and vision communities. These are published results, like the results with large language models, the results with ChatGPT, for instance, and stuff like that. So,
yeah, well, I still appreciate you being very open and sharing what you're working on.
Yeah, thank you.
Is there other things that interest you in this space that maybe I wouldn't know about and that you might clue me in on, hey, Tony, you should pay attention to this. This is kind of developing. Maybe here are some keywords you need to pay attention to.
I don't know. I mean, I think right now there's a big interest around generative AI in general, like DALL-E 2, ChatGPT, sort of like image generation, text generation, video generation. There are models right now that are out there that also do like biological data generation. So for instance, protein sequence generation. There's a recent Nature paper that came out on that, like text to protein sequences. So yeah, I think there's a lot of promise in generative AI and how it bolsters human creativity and in general, like human productivity. And so that's something that's very interesting to me. It's also, like you said, like generating market statements, for instance. These are all generative AI examples. So I'm generally in this space.
Yeah, now that's interesting because this idea of like generative models, like, so we talked about text and then you talked about images, you know, so there's text and images. What are other things that AI potentially could generate?
So text images are the most common right now. People are looking into audio, for instance. There is music generation by Google that recently came out. OpenAI also had that a few months back or something like that. There, people are looking into video generation. Obviously, it's a natural extension to images. People are looking into, even in other domains like biology, biotech and whatnot, people are looking into like protein sequence generations and stuff like that. It's just a matter of time people look into all these sorts of other things. Like, yeah.
Interesting. Tell me if this is veering outside of your domain expertise, but like things like music generation and video generation, it's fascinating. And AI is already transformative, but that's another layer of transformation that could happen. Like, what are the challenges for, like, say, video generation? Is it a training issue or is it like a computing issue? Like, what are the hurdles?
I would definitely say compute for now. Like, video requires like being able to generate frames. So you just, even generating images is very computationally expensive right now. It takes a long time. It takes a lot of power. Now imagine videos, which is like, I don't know, 30 frames every second, and making sure all these frames are semantically coherent and the video flows really well and whatnot. It's very, very computationally expensive. So I think a big bottleneck right now is compute and even the data we have out there. We have a lot of image and text data paired online because of how like people post and whatnot. Having video text paired data is very hard. So you have data, for instance, that's not quite aligned to the video. Like, right, because if you have narrations often don't quite illustrate what's actually happening in the video. Or even if you have, say, for instance, a title of the video, it's too vague to actually, you know, summarize the entire video. So having that data is also very hard. And obviously compute power, yeah.
Oh, I see. Because you're asking the AI to generate a particular video.
Yeah, yeah.
How do you describe the video? I mean, it's a kind of a languaging issue, like
exactly
like a movie like Saving Private Ryan. You know, like how do you describe that's the movie you want to see? You know, it's like, well, it's a war movie, but it's more than a war movie. You know, and
yeah.
Okay, well, so that's it's a linguistic problem too. It's like how do you okay? So that's. We there's some challenges there.
Yep.
How about the music case? Like, I'm into tango recently, and there's tango music that's come from a particular era. Like, it's like, say, the 1930s. And there's composers, and how soon will I be able to say, I want a tango music, and I want one violin, one bandoneon, one cello, one piano, in the style of a particular composer, Pugliese, and it has to be 3 minutes long. How far away are we from AI doing something like that? And what might be the challenges?
I think challenge again is having the paired music description data. So it's very easy for images to have these paired descriptions, right? Like, for instance, a cheerleader doing something for something or whatever, like a dog running towards a man or whatever. With audio, I don't know if it's very natural to find music sequences and their descriptions, like this imagined in the style of whatever, or, you know, there is data, but there is not large scale data of that. It's harder to find that sort of paired description of the music data. It's mostly music and the lyrics, right? And so that is a big bottleneck for AIs to learn, okay, this is the style of music. This is what it means for this style of music, or this is what it means for this. But then again, people have done it. OpenAI Jukebox, for instance, or Google's recent music model, I can't remember what it's called. They have trained on these, I think, lyrics and like descriptions of music and then to music. And it can generate things like this lyric in the style of country or whatever.
I understand. Yeah. Because I think it's a little bit more abstract and like you almost have to hire armies of people describing the music, you know? Where's the business model in that, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Which is prohibitive. Yeah.
So is there anything else that we should talk about today that we haven't? Like, I think we covered a lot of ground. Anything come to mind that you feel like we need to chat about?
We covered a lot of ground, and I think it was very exciting actually going through these questions. It also clears out your thinking process. Having these conversations and having this conversation with you, it like showed me what I'm doing is actually pretty cool. And I, you know, it also validates what I'm doing. And yeah, I think it's a great journey. I'll be a researcher or be an entrepreneur. I think either way, I'll be very happy.
I think it's a really interesting combination. I'm billing you as the scientist entrepreneur, and that's not two things I normally would put together, but it makes sense because as an entrepreneur, you're trying to figure out, like, is there some unique insight that you have that others don't have? And can you build it into a product, you know? And the right kind of PhD program could reveal some of those insights. So to me, they're not as separate as people think. If you have an inkling, you want to make something that can be put into the world. I think maybe that's the spark that you need to have to do both of these things. I think there's people that could live completely intellectually, and for them, maybe the entrepreneur route may not be the best, but for the people that, like you, have early on had this spark of, hey, I want to build something to put in the world, this scientist entrepreneur route seems like it could be really cool.
Yeah, I agree. And some of the most impactful things came out of like people being just scientists, right? Like the invention of like PageRank made Google, for instance. And so true. I believe impactful ventures, or like at least cool ventures, do come out from having a core scientific novelty and discovery and then building a product around it instead of going the other way around. So I think that's why I enjoy this route. I really enjoy it, just like having something new that I've done that no one else has done. And then I'm sure there are 1,000 ways to monetize that.
Well, fantastic. I hope you find one of them.
Exactly. That's the hope.
Thanks so much for joining me today in this informationally satisfying podcast. Wish you the best of luck. And if there's ever any way I can help, let me know.
Thank you. Thank you for having me on this podcast. I think it's a great idea. And it was very enjoyable. It was very stimulating talking to you. So thank you.
Thanks for joining us at the Super Prompt Podcast. If you liked what you heard, please subscribe to this podcast and leave us a 5-star review. See you next week at Super Prompt.